I would like to thank Rolando for the invitation. I changed slightly the title of my talk. So the new title is Quantum Memory Systems and Tensor Networks, Simulation Methods and Applications, which basically has the same information content as for the previous title. But, well, it was just a matter of taste. So, well, in this talk, I would like to give you an introduction of about what is these things that are called tensor networks, and in particular to explain you the background and the basics of simulation methods to simulate quantum many-body systems with tensor networks, together with some recent results that we have been obtaining at the University of Queensland, and also some applications that we have found about these techniques in order to understand better the entanglement properties of quantum many-body systems. So here is the roadmap that I would like to follow. First, I would like to explain you some history, and then I will explain you in detail what I mean by tensor networks and why these are important. Then I will move to explain you some recent results about the simulations of quantum many-body systems in two dimensions. And finally, I would like to explain you some further applications of these methods, particular to determine the entanglement properties of many-body systems. Okay. So here is the main problem that I would like to solve. And basically, here is also the solution. So the problem that I'm concerned with is how to represent efficiently quantum states of a quantum lattice system. And well, there are many ways of trying to solve this problem, and the approach that I'm going to take is to represent, or better, to divide the coefficient of the quantum state in terms of a tensor network that only depends on a small number of parameters. And by this, I mean if I have a quantum state of a many-body system like this one, I can pick up the coefficient of the quantum state, which is represented in terms of a very big tensor, and split this tensor into a tensor network, which depends on only a small number of tensors. And this basically depends on a very small number of parameters. Okay, so this will be basically the thing that I will be talking about in this talk. So here is the outline. First, I would like to explain you a little bit about history of these methods. Second, I would like to explain you what are actually tensor networks and why are they useful. Then I would like to explain you about simulation results for two-dimensional quantum systems, and finally about the applications of these methods also in the study of entanglement properties of many-body systems. Okay. Okay. So let me start with the brief historical review. So everything started in 1971. When Kenneth Wilson, he came up with his ideas about the renormalization group, and actually he got the Nobel Prize in 1982. And well, let me remind you that renormalization group, or RG, is about the identification of the relevant degrees of freedom of a physical system at long distances. About 20 years, more or less, later, Steve White, he came up with a refinement of the ideas of Kenneth Wilson in order to find a refinement for quantum lattice systems in one dimension, and he called that the density matrix renormalization group, or DMRG. So DMRG has had a huge impact, and in particular, it is the numerical method to compute the low energy properties of quantum many-body systems in one dimension. And on top of that, it has been the method of reference for the last 15 years, more or less. And to give you an idea of the impact of this method, I would like to show you this plot. In this plot, the black line, the black dots, are the number of citations to the original paper by White on the DMRG method. The red line is the number of published papers that contain the words renormalization group or density matrix renormalization group. And the blue dots are the number of electronic preprints that contain renormalization group or density matrix renormalization group. Okay. So you can see here that, the original paper of White is getting of the order of 100 citations every year and still going on. Okay. So just to give you an idea of the, magnitude of the impact of these methods, okay? Okay, so what is behind the power of DMRG? The answer to this question is, what is behind the power of DMRG is something that is called matrix protostates. basically DMRG is nothing but a method that tries to approximate the ground state of a quantum many-body system in terms of a particular type of tensor network that I will be calling all the time matrix protostate state. And the history of matrix protostates started in 87 with the AKLT model and the introduction of balanced bond states. And in 92, balanced bond states were generalized to what the people call already matrix protostates, although at that time, they called them finitely correlated states. And in 1995, the connection between DMRG and matrix protostates was found, and it was finally understood that DMRG is a variational method over the class of matrix protostates to find the ground state of a many-body system. So, some years later, in 2003, Giffre Vidal came with another paper, and this paper was within the context of quantum computation. This was a paper that was published in PRL, and the title was Efficient Classical Simulation of Slightly Entangled Quantum Computations. And if you read the abstract of the paper, and actually if you go through all the paper, you will see that this is a paper about efficient classical simulation of quantum computation, and has no reference to DMRG, renormalization group, matrix protostates, or something like that, okay? What Giffre was doing here without realizing was establishing a connection between quantum computation and DMRG, because what he was actually doing was using matrix protostates to simulate a quantum computer, okay? And well, he realized about that later, but basically in this paper he established without realizing at first the connection between matrix protostates and quantum computing. And after realizing that connection, he very soon came up with another paper in 2003 to simulate time evolution for one-dimensional quantum many-body systems. This was the so-called time-evolving block decimation algorithm, or TEBD. In 2004, it was understood also how to generalize these methods to periodic boundary conditions, and in particular how to generalize DMRG to periodic boundary conditions. And this is just an example of another development that was done by this time. This was done by Bestrade, Porras, and Thirac, but there was also plenty of other results along this direction also by this year, 2003, 2004.
Boundary condition from this representation here.
Yes.
It's just adding one tensor.
Yes. Well, and you have to understand well how to do the contractions of the tensors. Okay. So the method, the variational method, changes slightly. Okay. But basically, the main ingredient is really just adding an extra.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. All the people of DMRG have missed that for many years, and they now realize.
The contracting tensor is just as.
Well, the complexity is a bit higher. The complexity
because
is
you have more indices.
You have more indices. Yes.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Okay. Yep.
So obviously, a case of main interest for many body physics is translational invariant, or in the without periodic boundary conditions, you know, site invariant, I guess, states. But none of this matters. I mean, all of this still holds in the non-translational invariant case, although.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, for instance, if your system is not translational invariant, your matrix protostate can be not translational invariant. But I will talk a little bit more about that later, okay, when I discuss more about what is a tensor network actually and what they find. Okay, so in order to understand a little bit more what is the connection between quantum information theory and these new methods to simulate many-body systems, I would like to come again to this block, okay? Remember that the paper by Vidal was in 2003. And you see that starting in 2003, 2004, there is a sudden jump in the number of published papers on DMRG or renormalization group, okay? And I like to somehow understand this as well, the people of the quantum information community suddenly realizing, no, that they had something to do there, okay, and all of them suddenly starting to study these methods and these algorithms. So there were also proposals in order to simulate other systems, not only one-dimensional. And in 2000, it was there was a proposal in terms of tensor product states for b-dimensional systems. And in 2004, the method of projected entangled pair states, or PEPS, was also proposed for d-dimensional systems. And in 2005, there was a proposal in order to understand better scale invariant systems in terms of what they call the multi-scale entanglement renormalization ansatz, or MIRA, which is at the core of another renormalization group technique, which is called entanglement renormalization. So, in this transparency, I would like to give you a little bit of summary of what I've been saying, okay? The main message here is that in time, we started simulating very simple models in one dimension and open boundary conditions. And we have learned in time how to simulate more and more complex models, in turn by increasing the complexity of the underlying tensor network. So we started with something very simple and we start to complicate things until we arrive to really complex things that allow us to simulate very complex systems, right? Both in one dimension and also we are able to generalize to more than one dimension. Okay, so with this, I would like to conclude, the first point of my talk, and now I would like to explain you what are tensor networks and why are they useful. So let me imagine the quantum state of a many-body system, and I'm going to imagine that I have a system of n particles, and each one of the particles has p levels, okay? So this is a system of n p-level systems. A generic quantum state of this system can be written in this way, where I have these coefficients, C, I1, I2, until IN, and some local basis. Now, I'm going to think all the time, for the sake of simplicity, that I only have 9 particles. In order to make things more clear, the coefficient of the quantum state in the case of 9 particles is this one, C, I1, I2, to I9. And this is a tensor. This can be understood as a tensor of 9 indices. That is, each one of these indices here can be can take up to p different values, and for each one of the values of these indices here, I get a different complex number. So this can be understood as a tensor, okay? And for each one of the values of the indices of the tensor, I get a different complex number. And now I would like to introduce a diagrammatic notation for tensors, which is the following one. I'm going to represent tensors by balls, and I'm going to represent the indices of the tensors by lines, like this one. So this tensor here is going to be represented by this ball with these legs. And this typically depends on a number of parameters which scales exponentially in the size of the system, and therefore is not an efficient representation of the system, computationally speaking. What I'm going to do is a replacement. I'm going to consider a network of much smaller tensors which are interconnected among themselves. And in this case, I'm going to assume that I have one tensor for each one of the lattice sides, and then the number of parameters is going to scale only linearly in the size of the system. For instance, this ball here is going to be a tensor, A, and this tensor has 3 indices, I1, which I sometimes call this the physical index, and 2 other indices, alpha and beta. And the indices that are represented by legs between tensors represent indices that are contracted between the tensors, such that there is a sum. This is a common index between 2 tensors, such that there is a sum over all its possible values. Okay? And in practice, these bond indices are the responsible for carrying the entanglement properties of the system, as I will justify a little bit later. So in general, this representation of quantum states has a number of parameters that scales only linearly in the size of the system, and polynomially in the number of possible values of these bond indices, and this number of values I'm going to call it capital D, which is the range of the bond indices. So this is an efficient representation of a possible quantum state. So let me justify why this picture is really an interesting picture. If I want to represent the quantum state of a many-body system, I have several options. And one option that I have is, okay, let me represent the quantum system exactly by giving all the coefficients of the quantum state. this is the representation in terms of a generic state, which is the exact representation, and is good in terms of the correlations, because, well, it is the exact state, it carries all the correlations that it has to carry, but it's not good in the sense that, in principle, it is not an efficient representation, because the number of parameters can explode exponentially. Now, something else that I can try to do is to represent the state by a product state, okay? In terms of condensed matter physics, in the language of condensed matter physics, this is what they will call the mean field approximation. And this is good in terms of efficiency, because the number of parameters here is very small, but it's not that good in terms of correlations. Actually, this has no correlations in the system. So if I want to represent the correlations of the system, a mean field theory approach or an approach in terms of a separable state is going to be actually not very good, right? So what tensor networks do is actually something in the middle between the two. So a tensor network is a representation which is both efficient and correlated. So it takes the best things of the generic state and the product state representations into just one representation. Okay. So some examples of tensor networks. I have already told you about a couple of them. But one, for instance, is a matrix product state, which is a tensor network that looks like this one. And this is the tensor network that is at the core of methods like DMRG or methods to simulate quantum many body systems in one dimension. Yes?
Dimensional systems. I mean, I understand that the graph corresponding to the tensor network looks one dimensional.
Exactly.
But is it one dimensional in some other sense in terms of some physical system where it would be?
The interactions in the physical system are actually corresponding to a one dimension. So it's a one dimensional chain of interactions.
Space dimensional.
So it's like you have like a string of qubits, and they're only allowed to interact pairwise.
Exactly.
Isn't that the universal model for quantum computation? Is that not true? Therefore, you could construct states that might not be efficient in that representation.
I agree. But in this representation, what I'm doing is the dimension of these four indices, I will try to keep it always small. Okay. If I allow the number of values that these indices can take, if I allow this value to be exponentially big, then I can represent any quantum state. And in that sense, I can reproduce a universal quantum any quantum computation with them.
So if you have some bound on the size of these systems that you have on the dimension of these physical systems, and that doesn't necessarily translate into a bound of the degrees of those yellow
Among ones. The dimensions of what?
Like suppose I have n qubits.
Okay.
So they're all two-dimensional states. Then the tensor representation, it wouldn't necessarily have those yellow balls wouldn't necessarily have two inputs.
Well, if I let, as I told you, if I let the size of this index to be arbitrary with that, then I can represent any quantum state.
I think you're talking about two different indices, right? The qubits themselves are the yellow balls. They have two indices, one for each spin down, spin up. And then there's this bond dimension, which is a different degree of freedom.
And that's exponential.
The bond dimension, you can understand the bond dimension as the entanglement in the system. Okay? So the more entangled the system is, the larger has to be the bond dimension of the system. And in practice, what these tensor networks try to do is to represent explicitly what is the structure of the entanglement in the system. So if I have a chain of particles that are the ground state, are the lowest energy eigenstate of a Hamiltonian with nearest neighbor interactions in one spatial dimension, somehow you can assume that entanglement is going to be on a line, okay, flowing somehow on a line. And that is what this representation tries to find.
Let's talk about homogeneous couplings.
Homogeneous what?
Homogeneous couplings, like the same Hamiltonian in every pair?
Or inhomogeneous, yeah. So the system doesn't need to be even translational line.
So, but if you have 13-dimensional particles on a line, you get universality, like Richard said.
Yes, but
NPS doesn't work.
Probably, well,
the bond dimension.
But then this bond dimension will be exponentially large.
Like the number of lines between.
You will need tensors with exponentially many parameters.
So any state is emitted first. But the bond dimension, there's these bond degrees of freedom, that could be exponentially large. He's going to say, no, I'm going to cap that bond dimension at something polynomial. And for that class of states, everything is efficient.
Exactly.
In one way.
That was actually the idea of Vitrevidar in his paper to simulate quantum computations classically. Was, okay, let's represent the quantum state of the system by a matrix for the state, but I'm going to allow only a polynomially big number of coefficients here. Okay? And that is an approximation of certain quantum computations that only generate polynomially big amount of entanglement in as measured by this. Okay. So, well, these are just some examples of tensor networks, also projected entangled pair states, as I told you before, which are suitable for d-dimensional systems, and the multi-scale entanglement renormalization ansatz, or the NIRA, which is particularly good for the simulation of a scale invariant system. So it happens that now we can use these tensor networks in order to develop classical algorithms to simulate the physics of many body systems. And everything starts with the following observation, which is that many relevant quantum states in nature seem to be very well represented by these tensor networks, such as the ground states of some Hamiltonians with local interactions. And let me give you the following picture. Imagine the Hilbert space of a many-body system. And I'm going to imagine that this Hilbert space of a many-body system is represented by this circle. And this is huge. There is a huge number of states here that the system has access, okay? If I focus on separable states, this is just a small corner of the Hilbert space, okay? This is actually tiny. And this, well, corresponds to a tensor network in which the dimension of the bond indices is actually one. If I increase the dimension of the bond indices to 2, I get a bigger subspace of the Hilbert space. And if I increase it to 3, just a little bit more bigger, and bigger if I go to d equals 4, and eventually, for an exponentially large value of the bond index, I recover the whole Hilbert space of the many body system. So the idea of tensor network algorithms is to use a tensor network with a fixed and probably increasing capital D, where D is the dimension of the bond index, to compute the properties of quantum many body systems. Yes. That's okay. The index capital D can take any integer value. For capital D equals to a tensor network with capital D equals to 1. Is actually a product state. Okay, B equals 2 is not a product state, but is a state that has somehow a small amount of entanglement, as measured by capital D. Increasing capital D is actually increasing the range of the amount of entanglement that my wave function can have. Yes. In one dimension, yes. For the case of a matrix plot state, it's the Smith number of the Smith decomposition. In the case of more dimensions, or even if you go to more complex structures like three tensor networks, it represents something else.
But if it were homogeneous, it should still be the Smith
number. Homogeneous in?
If the entanglement were homogeneous in all the directions, it should still be.
No, I don't think so. For instance, I can explain you later. But
it is related to
this. Yes, in one dimension. Oh, it is related. Yes, so you can say that it is related to the Smith number in the sense that I think that the log of capital D is related is the maximum value of the entanglement entropy, for instance. For a bipartition of the system.
So if you know D, you know you have a bound for the system.
You have a bound for the entanglement entropy between two parts of the system.
What about the Schmidt number?
Sorry?
Do you have a bound for the Schmidt number as well?
Yeah. It's just D times the number of incoming vertices of the image. Very different bonds.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So let me now justify why tensor network algorithms actually work. One is that, as I told you already, tensor networks offer an efficient description of the system. Efficient, computationally efficient, in the sense that it only depends on a polynomially big number of parameters in the size of the system. Another observation is that they allow to compute expectation values of local observables, such as order parameters or correlation functions. And this is something that is exact in one-dimensional systems and is approximate in systems higher than one dimension. And actually, doing the exact computation in more than one dimension is an NP-hard problem. But it is always possible to approximate this computation
efficiently
in the sense of the system. Yes. Another nice property is that they allow for the efficient for an efficient updating after an operation. For instance, I can have a quantum state that is represented in terms of some tensor network, and I can apply real-time evolutions so that I can compute dynamics of this class of states, and I can also compute imaginary time evolutions, which in practice means that I can compute ground states of Hamiltonians. They also allow for the efficient optimization of cost functions. For instance, I can minimize the expectation value of some Hamiltonian, which again allows me to find ground states of Hamiltonians. And I can also minimize the distance between two different tensor, the quantum states that represent two different tensor networks. Well, this is something that is useful in some algorithms. They also allow to deal with infinite lattices, that is, quantum many body systems for an infinite number of particles, which is what the people in condensed matter call the thermodynamic limit. And this is possible to do in the case of systems that are translationally invariant.
I have a question. So finding ground states, isn't it known that even in 1D, running DMRG to try to find a ground state in 1D, doesn't that contain problems that are at least as hard as factoring?
Yes. Okay. But you can find an approximation to it. In those cases, I would say that the method fails. Or that the approximation that you get to through ground state of the system is very large.
Okay.
Or that you need an exponentially large time in the size of the system to get to ground state.
Okay, so what does efficient mean then in this fourth point here where you say perhaps?
Efficient in the sense that every operation that I have to do over the tensor network can always be done in a time that scales only polynomially in the size of the system.
Okay. But it might still be hard to find.
Yes, I mean, for instance, this evolution here, this time evolution, could be for a time that the scale is exponentially large. Okay, but that is something independent of the representation. It is independent of any method, actually.
So if you have a so that's true even if the Hamiltonian has a polynomial gap, right?
Mm-hmm.
An inverse polynomial gap. What if you have a constant gap Hamiltonian?
Well, I guess
I think it's okay in that case, right?
Yes, if you have a constant
gap, you're actually minimizing ground state. I see. So if H is a constant gap Hamiltonian with a true MPS ground state, then it really is. Okay.
Actually, if the gap is of the order of, well, if it is a constant,
yeah,
my guess is that in a time that is actually very small, of the order of 1 over that constant, you are going to be in the ground state. Okay. And another reason why these tensor networks are interesting is because when you go to the computer and program all these algorithms, it happens that the simulation times for these algorithms are actually much faster than some other algorithms that the people typically use, such as quantum Monte Carlo. And I'm thinking that some calculation of quantum Monte Carlo typically takes of the order of 1 month in a very big supercomputer, and the numbers that we are comparing with, which are actually these numbers in quantum Monte Carlo, the numbers that we obtain with tensor networks typically take of the order of 1 day or probably 2 or 3 days in a desktop PC. Okay. Yes.
So one thing that I haven't seen yet in your talk is mixed states.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to talk about mixed states?
No.
Okay. Well, then just a quick question, since you're not going to mention it.
Okay.
Is there much known about mixed states?
Yes. There is a way to represent mixed states in terms of what is called matrix product operators.
Okay.
And well, basically, all the machinery that works in the case of pure states, you can also generalize that to mixed states.
Okay. So
yes.
Do you have an example of that last point there? I'm not aware of a a case when the quantum Monte Carlo has been compared to an NPS algorithm for the same system size? I mean, is there an example?
Well, the numbers that I will show you later for the case of two-dimensional systems, we obtain those numbers and we are comparing them with the best Monte Carlo calculation.
Cool.
You will see that quantitatively later.
I can wait.
Okay.
So I have a question again about the minimization, you know, optimization of cost functions point.
Yes.
So you said that the minimum or psi can be obtained efficiently. You mean that so you fix, I guess, the one dimension, and what is the information you need for psi prime?
Psi prime? Okay, so what I want is to approximate psi prime, which is some state given in terms of a tensor network. I have all the tensors.
Oh, so psi prime is also one of the...
Psi prime is a tensor network.
With some bound on the bound dimension.
Yes.
And then
it is given to me, okay? It can be the output of some algorithm.
Oh, so that's an efficient representation.
That's an efficient representation.
So wait, if you're optimizing them over other tensor networks, wouldn't you just output psi prime?
No, psi prime? Oh, well, I assume that psi prime, psi prime is given, and I want to approximate psi prime by psi.
Smaller.
For instance, yes, or with some other type of tensor, okay? Or with a smaller bond dimension.
Or a different lattice structure.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay.
And my point is that you can do this efficiently.
Okay.
Because maybe you want to change the representation of the quantum state
for some reason.
Or you want to reduce the bond dimension, for instance. You want to find a cheaper representation of your quantum state.
Okay.
So if I give you the Schmidt coefficient for psi prime, is that enough to find the...
No, you need all the tensors.
All the tensors.
Yes, in the case of a one-dimensional system, you think? You need the whole MPS.
Okay,
all right,
so.
Okay, so, well, now I would like to go to the third point, which is, I would like you to show you some results that we have been obtaining on simulation, classical simulation for two-dimensional quantum mechanical systems with these algorithms. Something that we did about a year ago is to develop an algorithm based on projected entangled pair states or tensor product states. To simulate the properties of quantum many-body systems in two dimensions, and these systems are of infinite size. Okay, so we call this the infinite size PEPS algorithm, or IPEPS, where I means I means infinite. This is a cool notation. Well, this was a work done by Jacob Jordan, who is our student at the University of Queensland, myself, Vibret Vidal, and also Frank Verstraete at the University of Vienna and Ignacio Tirac at the Max Planck Institute in Göttingen. And the idea here is actually very simple. You have as an input a two-dimensional lattice Hamiltonian, and I'm assuming that the interactions are for nearest neighbors in the lattice. And you compute the ground state of the system by evolving a given initial state by an imaginary time evolution. And this is something that you can do efficiently if you are working with this tensor network states. At an output of this operation, we get an IPEPS, an infinite PEPS, that approximates the ground state of the physical system. And from here, we extract physical information in terms of expectation values of local operators, which is something that we can also do efficiently working in this representation.
So you need something else to be efficient.
Yeah. Sorry?
You need something else to be efficient. I mean, you need a promise on the gap, I guess. The gap of H has to be.
That depends on the model that you want to simulate.
Can you go back to the slide real quick, please?
Yes.
And those expectation values, did you say those were local observables? Or maybe like 2-point?
Well, local, a 2-point correlator is also local in the sense that it's localizing one line, okay? But we can also obtain 2-point correlators.
Okay.
The more local is observable, the fastest is the population. Yes.
So the quantum system you're simulating is infinite, but the tensor network, I assume you get finite, so.
Oh, this one?
Yeah.
No, well, I assume that it extends to, okay.
So you use some sort of a cutoff? Some...
No, it's infinite. I'm using translational invariance. The system is translational invariance, and if the system has this property of translational invariance, then I assume that I can assume that I have the same tensor at every side. And then I only need to keep one tensor.
Okay.
in my computer.
What's O?
What?
The output to have O.
O? Yeah. Oh, yes, some local observable. Could be a local observable. Some local operator that you want to measure the expectation value.
So, do you take the limit of n going to infinity, or you assume it's infinite?
It's infinite from the beginning.
And it's also translationally invariant.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's infinite with the form of the t you need there.
What
is the t you need there? Because for an infinite system, the gap is closed.
If it is critical, yes. If it is not critical, no.
Yeah. You can have well, but in general, you close the gap.
No.
Well, in you many cases of interest, you close the gap.
For instance, the next transparency. In the case of the quantumizing model, this model is critical for h equals 1. Okay? At that point, the gap is 0 in the infinite case, in the infinite limit, in the limit of infinite size.
Okay.
But if you are a little bit far away from this quantum critical point, you immediately have a gap, okay? Which implies that the correlation decays exponentially. In practice, this means that these methods are very good, are better. As you go away from a quantum point. Okay. At the critical point of a quantum phase transition, in principle, there are no methods that work. Okay. All the methods will fail. Precisely because it is not. At the closest you are to the quantum phase transition point, you start to see that the method is slowed down and so on.
Okay, so the promise in the last transparency is that the ground state is unique.
Yes.
But even in these gapped systems with unique ground states, it's infinite. Oh, okay. Okay, so really there is a constant gap for these systems.
Yes.
Okay.
So, for instance, we simulate as a benchmark, we simulated the two-dimensional icing model, quantumizing model on a square lattice with a transverse magnetic field. And this model, as I was telling you, this model is critical for h equals 1, which means that there is no gap. And that is a second, actually, h equals 1 is a second order quantum phase transition. Right? Away from that quantum phase transition point, there is a finite gap. And, well, in principle, you can do a real time evolution to finite time to finite ground state. OK, and well, we computed here, for instance, there is a plot of the order parameter, which follows the typical plot of the order parameter of this model, and we then computed it for different values of the bond dimension, and we observed that for between d equals 2 and capital D equals 3, there is an improvement in our results, as expected, because we are allowing more entanglement in the system. And well, we compared our numbers with those from the best Monte Carlo calculations, and we observed that there is less than 1% of relative error, both in the critical exponents and in the estimation of the critical point. And we started to implement tensor networks here for d equals 2, 3, and we just stopped because there was a point in pushing forward the algorithm for the IT model. Okay? This is in relation to what you said before.
Who's right?
Eh?
Who's right?
Both are right, I guess. I mean, these are two different methods. And
This is an exactly solved model, right?
So in two dimensions? No.
No,
only in one dimension.
No. Oh, okay.
Okay, so for instance, well, we also computed the ground state energy and the transverse magnetization and compared that to with some simple perturbative series expansions calculations that we did, which is the black line, and well, it compared very well. And even computed the critical correlation function as close as possible to the critical point. Well, we saw that it is easy to compute. It's actually efficient. We can compute that efficiently. And the result is actually non-trivial even for the small values of of capital D. Non-trivial in the sense that the values of this correlation function decay all exponentially, but this exponential decay is not very, very fast. Okay.
By critical correlation function, you just mean the two-point correlation function as a function of distance at the critical point of the model?
As close to the critical point as we can.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, something else that we did was a generalization of a classical algorithm to simulate the dynamics of a quantum system in one dimension that is called IEPDD. So The IPV, which means infinite time-evolving global estimation, is a method that, well, as I said, it allows to compute the dynamics of any quantum many-body system in one dimension, of a one-dimensional quantum many-body system. And this is what this was published by Giffre, Didard, and Pierre in 2007. This time evolution is assumed to be by two-body local and unitary operations. So what we did was to extend this method to simulate time evolutions as driven by evolution operators that are non-unitary, and used this generalization to compute the properties of classical lattice systems in two dimensions. Okay. And well, in practice, we generalize the method to several types of evolutions, such as matrix product operators or this kind of case from two sides to one or even to one to two sides. But in principle, one can generalize the method to any kind of local array. We use this method to compute the properties of the, as a benchmark again, of the two-dimensional classicalizing model in the square lattice, which is defined by this Hamiltonian. We computed the partition function and then computed the expectation values of the order parameters and some other quantities. And for instance, for the order parameter, we got these blue dots here. So these blue points are our numbers with the IPV algorithm generalized. And the red line is the exact result. So you can see that there is a almost perfect agreement. And inside, in this inset, there is a relative error, which is as long as you go a little bit far away from the critical point, it drops down to less than 10 to minus 10 very quickly. Okay. So there is also the agreement with the critical exponent and the position of the critical point was really, really good with respect to the exact solution. We also computed the critical correlation function. So we went as close as possible to the critical point, and we computed the two-point correlator between two distant things. And in principle, at the critical point, we have a forward log correlation, which is this straight line here, this pink line. And our numbers are given by these other lines. So, you can see that we get the correct forward log decay for several thousands of sites of separation, which it is quite impressive.
I have a question. Suppose that you weren't working with an exactly solvable model, how would you know where to stop trusting this calculation?
Well, in that case, what I will do is run the simulations for several. Well, this time here is the bond dimension of the in this case the matrix for the state, okay, of the tensor network that I'm working this time. What I will do is run the simulations for increasing values of this bond dimension and see that there is convergence. Okay, and when I see that at some point the values of my numbers don't change after increasing for several times the bond dimension, then I will start to trust that part of the results. Okay? Because, in that case, I will assume that part of the results is already converged. Okay. So we also simulated the Bose-Howard model in two spatial dimensions with the IPEPS algorithm. This is And we did it in the limit in which we can have either zero or one bosons at every side. This is called the hardcore limit. Mm-hmm. And in this limit, the Hamiltonian is defined in this way, and we got very good agreement with the numbers from other techniques such as quantum Monte Carlo and also stochastic series perturbative series expansions. Okay. Here, as an example, we computed many things, but as an example, here I show you our plot of the condensate fraction, which is the number, the density of bosons at the zero momentum mode as a function of the density of bosons at every side. Our numbers are the ones with the crosses, the pink and the green ones, for d equals 2 and d equals 3. And the numbers, these lines here, represent quantum Monte Carlo calculations.
And is it the reason is also very good.
Yes.
How fast?
Well, these numbers take, each one of these points takes probably a few or 1 or 2 days. Okay.
Yeah, no, Monte Carlo, how long does it take?
Several months.
At each of those points?
In general.
Yeah.
But you can run each of these points in a different CPU. Okay. So you can parallelize all the points that you can parallelize. and then just in one run, and then 24.
Okay. Now, I have a question about a previous slide about the quantumizing 2D.
Okay.
So,
quantumizing 2D.
Yeah. So, did you, you could only find the expectation value of local observables, not the ground state?
No, we computed the tensors of the tensor network for the ground state. And from that, we can extract
So you really have the ground state with all the quantum correlations.
Yes.
So you can also compute expectation value of non-local observables.
Yes, but that the more non-local is the observable, the less efficient is the computation.
Okay, so let me ask you this. If I ask you to compute the bipartite entanglement in that ground state, does it work or not?
You have to compute the reduced density matrix of half a system, right?
Yeah, for instance. Or a block.
In two special dimensions, right?
Yes. Even just a little block, I don't care.
You can go for 4x4 blocks, for instance, and you can still do that. Actually, we have done, but only up to 4x4, not more than that. Because 4 times 4, you have to compute a density matrix, okay, that is, well, you have 16 spins inside, right?
Yeah.
You have to compute a reduced density matrix, the whole reduced density matrix of 16 spins, and then diagonalize it and so on. So you cannot go much farther than that.
But there is a bunch of eigenvalues which are zero. I mean,
yeah,
you only need a small size.
For what?
To compute the entanglement. Then when you start increase the size, then you should be able to relate at least the new eigenvalues to the previous.
How you do that? You have to contract all the tensors, get the explicit representation of the density matrix, and diagonalize to see the eigenvalues. You cannot read, in the case of one dimension, you can read the eigenvalues directly from the tensors. But in 2D, you have to compute the whole density matrix and then diagonalize. There is no other way. So there is no way to read the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix directly from the tensors in 2D. And you have to go through all these.
And the Schmidt rank is still exponential because you have the number of incident bonds on a large block is still growing. So
yes,
you're going to have
I doubt that's the case for this model. For this model, the amount of Schmidt coefficients, non-zero Schmidt coefficients.
No, it is very large. Actually, in two dimensions, you get boundary loads for the internal entropy, which means that the number of the Schmidt coefficients is going to increase and increase, mm-hmm. like the exponential of probably the boundary, right? The size of the boundary. Mm.
So, I'm missing the point of the infinite thing here. What is actually the requirement unit, that there is translational invariance?
There is translational invariance, and then I can, all the tensors in my tensor network
yes.
are the same.
Okay, but
so I only have to keep one tensor in my computer.
So this is still fine as long as you have a finite system with translational invariance for various boundary conditions.
Yes, that's
then
fine.
This thing is still
works. Yes. Oh. Mm-hmm. You're right. Okay. Well, as I'm running out of time, I want to speed up things. Something else that we did was to compute the properties of the quantum orbital compass model with the IPEX algorithm. And this model is a two-dimensional model that it's actually quite simple to define. It's XX interactions in for instance, the vertical direction, and ZZ interactions in the horizontal direction. And it happens that this model has, a quantum phase transition, but it was not known what was the order, or at least there was some controversy about the properties of this quantum phase transition. And we determined conclusively with our algorithm that there is a first order phase transition. We measured the order parameters, and they were discontinuous, and the energy had a sharp peak at the critical point, and, well, there was some of that.
Can you calculate the gap?
Sorry?
Can you calculate the gap?
Can I what?
Yeah.
The gap.
Yeah.
Compute the gap.
Can you?
No.
Okay. Because this
not in the present.
This model might be used for self-correcting memory, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. Probably you can do by extensions of this algorithm to compute the gap. But for the moment, we just
you think that this is possible, or this is
simple? That should be possible, yeah.
Okay.
That should be possible. Okay, so something else that can be computed with these algorithms is something that is called the fidelity between different ground states of any body system. For instance, if you consider a Hamiltonian that depends on some parameter g, you can compute the ground state for different values of the parameter, compute the fidelity. This actually is normalized fidelity, where n is the size of the system. And it happens that this quantity is even finite in the case of an infinite system, and it has very nice properties in terms of detecting quantum phase transitions and what are the orders of quantum phase transitions, right? The nice thing of this quantity is that it is actually very easy to compute it with tensor networks. We did it in the case of the two-dimensional quantumizing model, both with a longitudinal and transverse magnetic field. And in one case, well, we saw that there is, as expected, you know, a first-order phase transition, and in the other, a second-order phase transition. And you actually can see the whole phase diagram of the system directly from this fidelity without relying on any computation of local order parameters. Right. And the nice thing about this is that this is very natural to compute with tensor networks. Something that we are trying to do now is to generalize these algorithms to incorporate symmetries, such as set Q symmetry U1 or SU2, in order to simulate systems with symmetries, internal symmetries, in a more efficient way. And well, this is still a work in progress. Well, we wanted to finish sooner. Right? Okay, and let me just go very quickly to the last point, not as quickly as before, okay? To the last point of my talk, which is some applications of these tensor networks in the study of entanglement in many body systems. So here there are two things, one is quantum information and the other one is condensed matter physics. And for the moment, I have shown you that entanglement theory, studying entanglement theory in many body systems, provides a justification to why some simulation methods in condensed matter physics actually work, okay, based on these tensor networks. What I'm going to do now is the other way around. I'm going to start from the ground state of some many body system that I know that the ground state can be represented exactly as a tensor network. And from that representation, I'm going to compute the entanglement properties of the system. Right, and that is something that, in principle, if I have the exact representation of the quantum state, I can do that very efficiently. Okay. So something that you can do, for instance, is to consider a one-dimensional system and divide it into blocks of length L, and compute what is called the global geometric entanglement per block. And this is the maximum overlap between the ground state of the system and a separable state of the blocks. And well, this is something that was introduced by Quay and Goldberg, and also it was used by Botero and Resnick. And in the case of a quantum both many body system in one dimension, when you are close to a quantum critical point, you can see that this quantity here obeys a universal scaling law, much in the same way as the entanglement entropy does, which only depends on the central charge of something that is called the underlying conformal field theory that is describing the universality class of the quantum critical point. There is a logarithmic scaling in terms of correlation length that is close to the quantum critical point, and at the quantum critical point, you can actually find an upper bound in terms of the central charge and also the size of these blocks here. And the trick to compute this is actually to pick up the ground state of the system, represent it as a matrix for the state, and once you have this representation, compute this quantity. And it is possible to do this analytically from scratch. Actually, it's also possible to do it in the case of the AKLT model. So the AKLT model is a model of spin one that, well, it's important in condensed matter physics for several reasons. But the nice thing here is that the ground state can be computed exactly. It's actually a set of spin one half singlets or maximally entangled pairs between different qubits, and a set of isometries, which actually what these do is to project every two spins in a spin one state. You can represent this state by a tensor network and then find a matrix for the state. And once you have the matrix for the state, you can compute again the geometric entanglement per block as a function of the size of the block. And well, you get a very nice expression that, and you see that as L increases, this term vanishes, and you get a saturation in logarithm of 2, okay, which, as expected, for a system that has that. Well, there are many things that can be computed in this sense. It is possible to try to understand better the entanglement properties of polar systems, such as the something that is called the SUN, aka LP chain, also to understand better finite size effects in entanglement properties of the systems, topological order, relation to mean field theory. And regarding simulation algorithms, well, it is still to be understood better how to implement symmetries in the algorithm, and how to simulate the two-dimensional Bose-Hubbard model, and also two-dimensional fermionic lattice systems. This is actually the hard problem to do, and well, we are working on that. And of course, there are many other things that, can be computed in, this direction. And well, this is what I wanted to tell you today.
So we still have a few minutes for questions. We had a lot of questions earlier.
Can you say a couple more words about the topological order? Are you going to compute the topological entropy or something else?
What I would like to understand is, just give me one second. Well, it doesn't matter. What I would like to understand is whether, for instance, one interesting thing to understand is whether these simulation algorithms can actually simulate systems that have topological order. Okay, in the sense that if, how to compute the ground state of a system that has topological order, if all the operations that I'm doing in my algorithm are all, always local, okay, how am I going to generate topological order from that, for instance? Or if there is some entanglement measure apart from the topological entropy that I can understand, that I can use to detect topological order, and that if that can be measured from the tensor network, in an easy way, because the topological the entropy of entanglement is something very complicated to compute from a tensor network. I wonder if there is something that is easy to compute and that is able to detect already where there is or not topological order in the system. Okay. Apart from the fidelity. Okay.
Because it's a global thing. So you want something global.
I need something exactly.
You know, the topological order in something global.
Mm-hmm. That seems like, by definition, impossible.
I don't know.
Can you comment briefly on the sign problem? Is there any manifestation of this?
No, there is a sign problem here. Sign problem is something specific.
So any fermionic Hamiltonian, any frustrated?
In principle, yes. You should be able to simulate that. Frustrated systems, fermionic systems, potentially, yes. Actually, well, we are thinking in that direction.
Well, if there are no more questions, let's thank everyone again.